Blog Talk Radio.
Mother's Medicine Cabinet. We weren't on last week because I had a little case of the sniffles, but this week we have Paul Coleman Robertson, Lynn Alexander, a dual guest, and we'll be going an hour tonight so we can get both of them in to do stuff, and they'll be presenting their new books here on your Mother's Medicine Cabinet, and I got two callers, so let's just bring them in. Hello.
Hi, Frank.
Oh, hello.
How are you?
Hey, Frank.
Hey. Hey, I'm just going to bring you on at the same time, and, like, you guys can both answer the questions that way because, you know, instead of doing one person and then bringing the other person on, which is a pain in the ass, I think. But
no, that's cool. I hope you're feeling better.
Nah, I feel fine. I was sick and grouchy for, like, 5 hours, and I didn't want to do the show. And I figured I was the guest, so I might as well screw it.
Okay.
So,
well, you can do that.
So how is, you guys can choose to answer whatever order you want. And how's Pennsylvania and California tonight?
Awesome.
You want to take that one, Lynn? Or?
Well, you know what? It's,
you're just going to leave it at that? You're just going to say awesome?
Yeah.
That's it?
Well, it's beautiful. You know, it's that point where it's not cold yet, but it's not hot. It's like 70. It's great. So yeah, it's like California is most of the time.
Has your leaves started turning like they here have up here in the prison that I live in?
They have not really. I mean, they're becoming a little bit brittle, and you know they're getting to that point. We haven't had a frost yet. Usually we have a good frost, and then everything sort of deteriorates after that. Yeah. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm still getting tomatoes, so it's good. It's great.
First, I'm gonna ask Lynn, and then Paul can answer the same question right after, or Paul can answer first. It doesn't matter how you want to do the order. But why don't you tell us the title of your book and where it's coming from and that stuff.
Okay. You know what? I'll let Paul go first because His is actually
I have something in queue from Mr. Fuggett's Tainted Coffee Press. That's my first collection of flash fiction called Sometimes You Invent New Words for Old Losses. And you can probably guess that, you know, I've really sort of taken a lot of my sort of spoken word, sort of plain narrative poems and really just sort of transformed them into these flash fiction pieces. And I've been doing that for a lot of years, and I thought it was about time I really formally sort of shaped them into that. And I have to give a lot of credit, a lot of inspiration for doing that and going ahead with a project like this came from Josh Olson, actually, who I think is a really fan. The more I read him, the more I just really grow to appreciate what he does. In his sort of quiet, plain spoken. If we have a modern day Raymond Carver, he might be the closest thing in the small press we have to it. With the sort of level of honesty and the plain spokenness to the animal condition of the human beings. You don't see a lot of that in literature. You see it get dressed up a lot as these other romantic ideals, but I think Josh speaks to it pretty honestly. And I don't know that I achieve what he achieves, in terms of the writing, but for those things that do resonate in my writing, I wanted to try to, deliver them in that form.
Cool.
That's the nice little thing that Mr. Fuget will be doing for me when he gets that out, and I suspect we'll have and I'm hoping that the artwork will be provided by Miss Lynn Alexander here, who I know has an incredible shot, a credible concept for a cover that we hope the Tainted Coffee Press masters will see fit to put on the front of that manuscript.
Cool. It's just like and you said that it was your first venture into publishing your flash fiction. Is that what you said?
Yes, okay. It is. I mean, as a collection, I've had little things published here and there, but never as a collection. I've had a lot of poems as collections before, maybe some prose poems, which could sort of borderline. I mean, the line between poetry, especially narrative poetry and flash fiction, has been very blurry for quite a few years now, and I know a lot of people who have played both sides of that. But yeah, that is essentially correct. Yeah.
Cool. And there's no word on when it's coming out, or is that later in the year or next year or?
No, we were hoping to have it out for the Mothpocalypse. Last word I got from Brian is it probably won't be ready for Mothpocalypse and Happy Fucking Endings. So, yeah, probably looking at next year. Looking at a release date of, I'm hoping early next year. That looks to be the timeline for that.
Yes, I've learned myself in the past that putting a book out right at Christmas time is a pain in the ass.
It certainly is. I would much rather wait. I would much rather wait till afterwards. It's a lot easier that way.
And Lynn Alexander, why don't you tell us about your book?
Well, you know what this is? It's a funny thing. Michelle McDonald and I were doing some books for some of the readings that we were doing in the summer. And I actually had a few things with a different press. And we ended up doing it and having it out when we were out there, when you were out there also, for Zyfez 2 and Toxic Abatement and the events out there. But, it's called Prologue to Mariami. And it's not historical. I mean, I don't want to make you nervous and make you think that, but it is inspired by the story of Mariami, who was actually the wife of Herod the Great. She was executed, and what's fascinating about her, fascinating to me, is some of the themes that sort of come to mind with her, because one of his instructions were that if something should happen to him, if he should die, that she should be executed. And, she learned about this plan and obviously was upset about it. And, but it's not really about her. It's more about the idea of women having the right to life, to love, to exist in their own, in their own right, to their own importance, to not have their existence dependent on being, the object or, the possession of a man. And it's also about like the validity of anger, when she's upset about this, one of the accusations comes out that she must be running around, and she ends up executed anyway. So, you know, I do have sort of an interest in, you know, mythology, themes like that. So it's, like I said, it's not about her necessarily. They're just sort of inspired more by the idea of possessive love, of ownership, of, you know, validity, of gender, all of those things. Yeah.
Is it kind of like, sort of, maybe not, but I'm just trying to get a concept of, like when Charles Olson wrote his Maximus poems, he had a character in many ways that he brought throughout the collection.
Right. I think sometimes what happens is that it becomes almost almost like a recurring, like a motif, some of the themes that come out in a story like that, which is really a very horrible story, you know, the idea, you know, of, you know, well, you know, there were a lot of, you know, horrible stories in ancient times, but, you know, the idea of, you know, killing your wife if something should happen to you, and then killing her just because you, you know, you think she's, you know, protesting too much. But yeah, I think it becomes sort of, I would say it sort of is a recurring thing, not necessarily her, but sort of the symbol of who she was, and yeah, I think so. I think it does come up a lot. Not just her. I think maybe a composite of different women that sort of embody some of those ideas. You know, I think they definitely come up in different places, you know. So it's similar, yeah.
No, that's it. You both have to excuse me. I've never had two guests on at once. So left brain and right brain are trying to comprehend in a way. But so you explained it all. Would someone like to read one of their things? It doesn't matter which one of you would like to go. Well, you're both gonna go. So
yeah.
Have you got something ready, Lynn? Or
well, yeah. I mean, I have different things. I know it is difficult having two people on at the same time, and you know,
well, but
I.
Well, there's plenty of time. There's like 50 minutes, so you don't have to worry
yeah.
about it. We'll have plenty of time to read.
Yay.
I've questions
I like
lined
that.
Up, so.
Okay. Well,
okay.
Do
you want to go in or do you want me to go?
Yeah.
It's fine. I mean, I can go. I mean, I can go if you want me to sort of give an example a little bit, I guess, of what I was talking about. But I could do that. And this is actually from that collection. It's short. It's, you know, it's not like a huge collection of poems. It's a chapbook. And, you know, as you know, chapbooks are meant to be sort of easily, you know, they're portable, they're inexpensive. They're meant to sort of be, you know, something you can kind of give away. So it's a pretty short book in the first place. But this is called Fingers Growing Furious. And this is also, it's in the same chapbook. Fingers growing furious. Wet left. Weeping skin would leave in steam. When faces leave their stations, they grow strange. Covered in the film of things, hands fan the things that vanish. Flames obliged of all things body. Black, the ash corporeal. Black, the lap across the skull. She waits. The drape of linen never comes. Dense beneath herself, orbs exhumed, left describing in her mind without eyes. Soon she is a scribe without text, woman without implements, fingers without instruments. Silent in the dampers, they sat back and watched her fingers growing furious. When first it was too much, there was reachable witness, the claim of their consensus kept the flap of fuel in the clasp of arms that bellowed. Hands that fanned the air to ash, the black to vanishing. Soon her dust was in their rugs. Erased of all things base and cranial, woman burns mute but furious in the death chew. Erased of name and place, a swaying trunk loose-limbed like a wild hose, turned to jerking spells of taut lips once wet, stretched at the crowning, head now nub, cunt coal in the black retracting. Clit cooked to juice the amber estuary, female flaccid now a statue, charred to bark. Silent in the dampers, they sat back and watched her fingers growing furious. If she squatted now, only black would smack the floor. Wet in that last transcendent mastery, the true last tension of the muscle clung to bone. Layers, their compressing acts, the black to vanishing. Soon her dust was in their rugs. That was,
well, that
Fingers
was,
Growing Furious.
I very much enjoyed that poem. As you and other people know, that I'm a fan of many different types of writing, and I very much enjoyed that one. Do you have a method that you use, or is it just kind of like whatever comes to you at that moment, or do you like work on them exceptionally long or short? Or?
If I had to sort of confess my method, it would be that I take stacks of things, and Paul can probably would probably chuckle about this, but I take stacks of things and then I compress down pages and pages and pages into something that becomes very condensed and short. A lot of people say, you know what, everything you do seems to be so short and so condensed and, you know, condensed and compacted. And I do that because I'm not a fan of volume. So what I try to do is just take out as much as possible, you know, to sort of I leave what I call the skeleton in place, you know, and that's what ends up on the page. So it's a very, there's a lot of cutting and a lot of paper that just doesn't make it in. So if that's a process, then that's my process. Distillation, I would call it.
So Paul Coleman Roberts, you're up to bat.
Okay. I can do a little piece from the book. One of the little flash pieces here. I'll do this one. This is called Fog Rise. Fog Rise. Home is where the toothbrush is, next to the Toms of Maine black fennel toothpaste tube that must be rolled up properly, where the sink is an old Victorian wash basin with small carved handles set straight into the wall, taking little more than 5 minutes to barely reach a warm trickle. Time enough for Mom to brew two mugs of fine ground Italian coffee with two shots of Kahlua. She hand rolls the fattest, stickiest joint you've ever seen. This is her idea of a soft pedal to the metal hard cell. Danny sits in his high chair, ripping off epic slabs of Eggo microwave waffles. This is the only true and proper way to watch Phil Donahue. Thanks, Mom. Of course I'll stay home from work. Of course I'll stay home from school. I'll take Danny down to the beach, and we'll listen to the soundtrack of the eons pounding and watch tide pool aliens and their watery planets. Of course, we'll tumble head over heels down ancient sand dunes, play hide-and-seek in fog shrouds. Of course, I always wished these days would last forever, but to say so now would end them. And why invite that tragedy now, when it will find us, when it finds everyone, sooner or later anyway? The water's hot now, and I'm going to run a bath. Home is where the old clawfoot bathtub is.
Excellent, Mandy. Now, do you, I understand, like, I don't really understand, like, fast fiction too much, but, I mean, it reads like a poem to me, it sounds like a poem.
The lines are very blurry, and I know that there's a writer friend and I, we have a game where, like, you know, somebody reads a piece and go, okay, is that flash fiction or is that a poem? And it gets I don't know, after enough alcohol, it gets to be a pretty ridiculous argument.
Yeah, but does it is this all stuff that you're inventing, or is this coming from actual experience? Because
this particular one is actual. I guess you wouldn't call it fiction. Maybe you call it flash nonfiction. It's a scene. It's a snapshot from my younger life, from when I was growing up in Humboldt County.
Cool. Do you miss Humboldt County?
Let's see. The most diplomatic answer I can give is no. I do not miss Humboldt County. Here's the deal, Frank. I went to high school there. How many people do you know want to live where they went to high school?
Oh, definitely not. I don't think that I want to return to my original town. There's no one there anymore.
It feels like most people you wouldn't know. My hometown is still there. My hometown was populated. It was a dairy town, population 200. And there's like just I would just be a ghost there if I went back. I mean, I can see places that I recognize and that feel familiar, but it would not be familiar. It would be a different world altogether. And so I write, sometimes you write little snapshots like I just read to, you know, sort of hang on to that place in time that was then. But, you know, because it was then and that point in time, that point in time never exists again. That place never exists again.
Yeah. So if anybody would like to call in that's listening, you can and ask Paul, Lynn, or both of them a question. Feel free to do so. Jeffrey, if you're out there, please call in before the last 5 minutes of the show. I'm going to give this question to both you guys, and I ask everybody. When it comes to art, say writing, because, you know, that's what we're discussing here, do you think there's more pros or more cons to the Internet being involved?
Can I just step into that? I'll go ahead and step into that. I don't think you can really say there's one of more or the other. I think there's a certain school of thought that says that the Internet has made it a lot worse, that it has democratized the it's a little bit like Prometheus stealing the fire from Olympus and, you know, giving it to the humans down on the planet to share, and the gods are kind of looking on in horror, thinking, oh, my God, the commoners have the key to the kingdom now, and they're bad. But it's, I don't know. I think it might as well. It's not a process you can stop. And I think poetry's transition from an elitist art form, which it once was back in the classical days of history, because obviously the only people who could write poetry were the people who could read and write, and you had to be very privileged to be able to read and write in the classical days. So it was an art of the elite, and it set rhetoric and it set tone. It was a primary art form at one point. And now it's, well, I mean, there's, you know, there are whole legions of poets out there dedicated to the gutter now. Say poetry has become the ultimate democratic art form, or one of the more ultimate democratic art forms. But I think it was in that transition anyway. I think that was going to be part of its evolution all along. So I think it might as well go to the Internet. I think in the end it's the purpose it was meant to serve. And I don't want to think of it so much as sort of the unwashed masses getting a hold of it. Well, maybe I do a little bit. But I guess it's. I think of poetry really as the punk rock of literature now. Because I think that somebody who comes to the form of poetry is able to be good and spare and economical and tell the truth. And if they start from that place and pay attention to what they're writing and what they put down, I think it is possible to step into it and be, I think some people have the gift and the ability to be a great poet immediately. I would certainly not call myself one of those people. I think I worked my way into being, you know, a passable, maybe above average poet, maybe. but there are some. I mean, you find these rare examples of phenoms who just have the gift and the voice, and they have it from early on in their lives, and maybe they discovered it then, or maybe it took them a little bit longer, but they are fantastic. And so I think, you know, as long as those people are out there, why not have the Internet to help them? Why not have the Internet help to get those voices out there? Because I think it does help get the voices out there, even as it dilutes the larger art form with really, really, really horrible bad poetry, stuff that, you know, really belongs in high school diaries, is all over Facebook, and of course you even saw it as early as the days of MySpace, and you looked at it and go like, golly, you know, and some of these people, you know, feel like they're getting famous, you know, and they feel like they have a career, and that this is really, and it's like, well, I don't know, it's poetry, and it's still a democratic art of the masses, so you'll get reality checks soon enough. Going up, and I think any of us who've been in the game long enough have had plenty of reality checks in it. You know, it's not easy to stick through with it and hang in there. People I see hanging around for a long time, yeah, you know, they get my respect, whether it be in the small press, the hard copy, the Internet, whatever. The more people, the more chance there are for the voices. I'm all for the Tower of Babel. You know, I just wrote about that in Red Fez. If it gets the good voices out there, then I'm all for it. That is my long-winded answer.
That's okay. I think you broke down the most. Most people just give me like the one or two line answer. I think it would benefit, but I would have to agree with much of what you said, anyways. But
right.
Lynn Alexander, are you still there?
Yes, I am. I think that the if I could add something to it, I think that one of the issues, there are many issues, but one issue in particular with the internet is the economic issue, the resource issue. You know, it's very expensive to run a press. It's very expensive to put out books. It's expensive to market them. The whole thing is expensive. And one of the things, whether you like what's out there or you don't like what's out there, I think that the work speaks for itself, whether it's on a page or it's on a screen. And I think that, you know, this rush to sort of demonize the internet as, as this horrible thing that's destroying, you know, poetry because it's allowing all of these, you know, these losers into the fold. Well, you know what? You know, I think that I feel very strongly about not having barriers, not having doors, not having towers that people can't get to. I think that the more doors we break down and the more accessible we make things to one another and our communities, the better it is for the art. And I think that that's one of the things the internet does, is it addresses the resource issue and that huge disparity between people that have nothing, have no cash, have no way of getting that work out there. You know, it gives them a vehicle to be known, to be read, to connect with other people that share their love for what they're doing. It builds community. It builds community in a way that's unprecedented. So, I mean, I agree with everything that Paul had to say, but I would also say that it also, there's that economic issue that, you know, yes, there's the democracy of it, there's the accessibility of it, but there's also the fact that anybody anywhere, if they want to, you know, can put their work out there and share it with people. And I think that's a wonderful thing, you know, and that's something you can't do with paper, that you can't do with books. So,
well, no,
you know,
I would totally agree with that, what you're saying there, because I think of myself looking back and remembering when, you know, when I was absolutely terrible, you know, and I had no idea how to connect with anybody or get what I was writing at the time 10, 15 years ago or 10 years ago out there. I use the internet as a great source. I probably wouldn't know half the people or been to half the readings I've been to or discovered half the publishers without it. You know, I needed it. But we have a caller for you guys, so let's see who it is. You are on with Lynn and Paul. Who's this? Hello? 508?
Oh, hey, Frank. Yeah. Jeff, how you doing?
Hi. Do you have a question for Paul or Lynn or both of them?
Yeah, you know, actually, I was having trouble listening to the show, so I was actually listening on the telephone, so I really didn't have a question. They were. I came in the middle of the discussion about the internet, and I believe Paul was making the comparison, the Promethean comparison to the dispersal of the knowledge to the masses, and Lynn was stating, you know, how it, the accessibility now takes it, you know, is a good thing. And I agree. I think that it's certainly, as you were saying just a moment ago, Frank, it is opening a lot of doors for a lot of people and connecting people to a lot of people, whereby that was, you know, just, you know, 10 years ago was not easily done. So overall, it's a good thing. But I think the point also has to be made, too, that there's a lot of sifting, too, that you have to kind of do as well. Because now with that mass amount of work that's being out there, that's being placed out there, you know, there's a lot more to kind of go through, if you will.
Right. Yeah, no,
which isn't really a bad thing.
Well,
I think that's true. I think that's true, but I think it's worth it. You know what? I think it's worth that price, the sifting and the work that sometimes it takes to find the things that you want to read and the writers that you want to follow. I think it's worth the sifting. You know, and I wouldn't change that. I mean, I know it's more difficult, and I know that it's a challenge, and that there people refer to the glut of internet content, and I think we all feel that, and you know, it is difficult to wade through it, but I think it's still worth it because of what it does for us. You know, you have to wonder what the people with the keys are so afraid of. You know, that they don't want you know, I think the more people that have power and are empowered in their art and their creative work, the better it is. So, yeah, I think that's a good point, though.
Yeah, I've got to cut in for a second. So, Jeff, hang on a second. I'm going to have, at the halfway point, I'm going to have both of them read a poem or one of their pieces, and then we can take it from there. So, Paul or Lynn, whichever one wants to go first is fine.
How about I'll go first this time, and then you can follow up there, ma'am? Okay, all right. I'm going to read a newer piece here that it just really just poured out of me a couple of days ago doing a 30 and 30 challenge became a 30 and 40 challenge. Might be in the 30 and 42 challenge. But I am going to be getting this piece out. This is called, I'm hoping to perform this at some point in Albuquerque, and this is called Return to the Hoodie. And this is, and just so it's known that this is inspired in great deal by the fact that Frankie Metro and Lindsay are down there are still in possession of my hoodie, but I am also in possession of her purple hat. So this is a poem inspired in the effort to barter a trade for some valuable clothing items. So this is a return to the hoodie. You beautiful derailed train, and all of us with our penetrating pupa would love to loll in the desolation of your landscape wreckage if it weren't for the fear of moving back into the shrub motel next to the highway, whose lot number you get tattooed all over your chin every time you lose yourself again. It's time that you crawled back beneath your pinball hoodie and got back to procuring breakfast before your iron and bronze master, with his chamber of commerce sneer and backstabbing small talk, comes hurtling over the far horizon. This is what you get going back to sublimating beneath the machinations of billions of gaseous eyes pulling their favorite marionette back up into the hills to keep that oh-so-baleful eye fixed on the ghetto mosquitoes and smearing your morning man-crotch stink all over the sidewalks of the bourgeoisie, who themselves seem to have no problem immersing themselves in the feces of trees and insects. Getting back to this in the dark, you will find you can turn the tables upon the attractive eco-boomers who once swooped down on you from above, and you find even more that you want to do it and that they want you to do it. So just fucking do it, because you will still find the possum bloated on trans fats and the reaper still rolls down the car window so his old lady doesn't get wise to the smell of cigarettes before dawn.
Man, I hope I don't get any air clothes.
There's a lot to see. You put on that hoodie, it's an action-packed morning.
But, Lynn,
man.
Lynn, would you like to follow up with Paul's magnificent hoodie poem, which was great, by the way?
His great hoodie poem. Well, you know, as Paul knows, I've been sort of reminiscing. You know, there was a time in my life where I spent some time in Europe in different places. Sort of a different person than how I am today on the phone with you, Frank. But this is Paul knows this one. But this is Nobody Gets Scurvy in Germany. And I thought I actually never read this out loud to anyone. So I thought, you know what? You know, it'd be fun to sort of just, yeah, talk, you know,
Kirky,
do it right here.
Kirky.
Yeah. Oh, no. So this is Nobody Gets Scurvy in Germany. Thought I was dead, a chorus of German, blending in my head into God. I think one of them fucked me. Is this the punk you love? I was skinny and sick, legs like fishnet-covered sticks. He said my ribs felt like plastic knives. Was he inside me? All that writhing till the fix made his dick limp. Fuck, our kind of punk was ugly. Eyeliner on top of eyeliner, raccoon eyes, lids necrotic, glued on spiders. We were sick. Our kind of punk was ugly, and that was the worst way of skank I had ever been back then. Was I dead? Our kind of punk was ugly. It wasn't Hot Topic vodka in college, adorable mall clothing and Converse studded collars, being badass bad, pretending to like Black Flag, watching Sid and Nancy on Laura Ashley Sheets. Our kind of punk was ugly. This kind of punk was ugly and frequently disgusting. Their crotches were sticky. They had plaque at their teeth. These were motherfucking junkies. Not the junkies poets pretend to be. Not the junkies on TV. Not the junkies I wanted them to be. These were motherfucking junkies that cold-ass robbed their families. Is that the punk you love? So there they were, Berlin, circa 91, squatting at Twatstrasse, this gaunt fuck from Prague mumbling 1 o'clock, two flashlights, one in each hand, doing some slow dance, doing the clock, but not really getting it right, facing white sheet again, but he was only at 10, but time was getting like that. The art lacked motivation. He was back in the corner. Nobody checked. Maybe he was dead. But now, white sheet was free for sex silhouettes like shadow puppets, only motherfucking junkies trying to fuck artistically. Is this the punk you love? That was white sheet, theater of the obscene. He didn't invent it, but he thought he did. A genius, and we let him think this. Bored as shit at Twatstrasse and might as well think up a scheme. Silhouettes, honestly, ease the details we didn't want to see. Like scabies, track marks, junky bodies. I mean, bitch's thighs look like she squatted on a pile of barbed wire. The guy had gravel burn and violence. God knows where those two were used to fucking. Is this the punk you love? The lights made them sweat. They smelled sour, anal, something you might describe as vaguely agricultural, maybe. Sick. Time to tap it back and take a nap. Back to the dream, or whatever it was. That part I said about being dead, or how the body pretending to be dead, but just not telling you the truth. Just the juice, they assumed, but dead was my best guess. Everything dead but my damn fucking ears. All I could hear was music starting, then stopping and puking. Then it was quiet, then it wasn't, then an insect on the ledge. Then it was daytime, and then it wasn't. Then the lights were back on sex. Then sex left rather abruptly. The eyes came back to life. Staring at white sheet, the corner was yellow. Someone had taken a piss on it. Punk was ugly. We were sick. It was dark and then it wasn't. I was wet and then I wasn't. I was dead and then I wasn't. And white sheet slipped down off the wall. It was white sheet, then it wasn't. It was an animal crawling across the floor. Bees stung my legs. My kneecaps went cold. Puke and piss and stings and white sheet knocking on the door. It was there and then it wasn't. Punk was ugly. There was pain. Someone had been inside my asshole. Is this the punk you love? If you can fall down in the street, the Germans will come get you, scrub you up, get the goth shit from your eyes, take you away from this mechanical dancing, give you oranges. Nobody gets scurvy in Germany. Swollen gums, your tongue still goes to the socket even now. You got to be fucked to sit there with your tooth in your hand. He stops ramming your ass long enough to throw it. Who knows where it landed? Couldn't hear, goddammit, trance dancers. Is this the punk you love? If you can fall down in the street, they'll collect you. Find your mom if you died, a German Jane Doe. The morgues might report it to the embassy if someone inquired. If anyone knew you were missing. Otherwise, you're just a dead motherfucking junkie in Berlin. The kind of punk you love. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's nasty, right? That's nasty.
I like it. Wow.
So, that was really good. So, as vulgar as I've seen Lynn Alexander get.
She's got that whole other side. She's got that whole other side.
She does.
I'm sorry, Frank. Can I ask a question?
I was just going to say, if Jeff, do you have a question now that you've heard some of their poems?
Yeah, powerful. Great, great stuff. Good job, both. I mean, very powerful.
Thank you.
Do you both write when you're writing the poems? Are you writing with the medium of more the spoken for the spoken word as opposed to the written word? Because I think there can be kind of a fine line between the two, you know, that you have a lot more wordplay, I think, that goes on with the written word, whereas for the spoken word, I think you get more into that kind of almost narrative type of confessional style of poetry. And I was wondering, when you sit down to write poems, are you writing to think, to perform in front of an audience, or for the silent ink of the page, if you will?
That's a really
for
cool
me,
question. Wow.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Go ahead, Paul.
I do both. I like to bring in a lot of exercises that restrain that voice. I had training in community before I became a poet. I studied professionally as an actor for about 4 years, and and you know, I did, and read a lot of lines. So I do have this natural performance. A lot of my pieces, I don't really develop them for performance. I think when I'm writing, I try not to focus about performance when I'm writing, and sometimes I do things like I do, Fibonacci sonnets that are, you know, sort of these numerical tricks.
Oh, I love Fibonacci sonnets.
You know, Fibonacci, yeah, it's a great form. It's one of the great forms. You know, I like to employ forms. Some of this stuff is very, cliche, the sort of the repetitive line listing and things, you know, that, you know, so many beats made famous. But, you know, if they're used in the right way, in the right kind of a newer subversive context, you can sort of, you know, make older forms more entertaining. So you can kind of bend it towards the stage and you can bend it towards the page. And I think you have to have a fine balance of the two, or at least, you know, given my background, I try to have be conscious of the two. But I also find that if there's a piece that I think, man, I think this would be a great spoken word performance piece, and I start trying it out, I inevitably wind up rewriting it. It inevitably goes through an evolution, even if it's been published somewhere else. I'll totally change it to make it more stage friendly. Years down, and I mean, I'm talking years and years later with a piece, I'll do that. But then, you know, and some pieces the way I'm inspired to write, some are sort of the love of just going kind of crazy on the page, and sometimes I like to be experimental and do stuff. I love to do corpses and exquisite corpses and found collaging. You know, I love to use little techniques like that. That's a lot of fun for me. Yeah, it's great to do that stuff. And if you get into it, there's no real excuse for being writer blocked. You really have to have the energy and the time to do. Sometimes writer's block is just an attitude too. And sometimes you can't write. Sometimes you just have to take a break from writing, and it's okay to do that. You know, but it's good to be able to kickstart yourself too when you're ready to kickstart yourself. And those are things that, so. Yeah, it's some kind of schizophrenic about it. I go back and forth between the two worlds, probably to my own detriment. But I wouldn't have it any other way either.
Very good. Yes, segues nicely into the question. Oh, Glenn, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely.
Oh no, I would just say that. I mean, I hear poems in my head. I mean, I'm both. That sounds crazy, but I mean, I hear the words when I'm looking at them, and I don't know that everybody. I think it depends how your mind works, you know. But I think it definitely. I mean, I really think that poems in general are meant to be read out loud. I mean, there are certain poems that you know I love on the page, and honestly, and I hate to say this, would bore the hell out of me if they were read. But I love just being submerged in the words and the text and the language, and being able to do that internally. But even internally, it's still audible to me. So I think that I've tried to get away from it, but I still hear it. I still hear it in my head as though it's being read. So I wouldn't say that I write for it being read, because for years I didn't read anything at all. I mean, over 10 years I didn't read anything out loud to anyone anywhere. So I wouldn't say that I write anything with the idea, the notion of reading it out loud, but it's just the way that I hear things and process things. So, yeah, I think so. I think out loud, yeah.
Very good. Yeah, me and Frank have had a few discussions on this too, and Paul kind of touched upon it with the forms and experimenting with forms, and it kind of segues nicely into a question that Frank asks a lot on the show, and I think it's an important question too, and that is bringing poetry back to the main, I don't want to say mainstream because that makes it seem cheap, but bringing poetry to where, elevated back to where it belongs. And, you know, we've had discussions about being in the shadow of the beats for a long period of time and kind of breaking through. And what do you, both of you, what would you say would be something that can kind of take it into a new direction and make it more accessible to the general public, besides us poetry lovers, poetry fields, however you want to phrase it.
You want to take that one, Lynn?
Well, I think it speaks to what society's priorities are. I mean, you know, unfortunately, we're a society that claims to be too busy for everything, but watches a hell of a lot of television. And you know, I mean, not that I'm knocking that, but you know, I think that you have to find a way to remind people of what's enjoyable about it, you know? And unfortunately, I think that a lot of people think, you know, a reading is you sit there and you're half asleep and you're not engaged and you're bored by it, and it's, you know, I think it does have to be engaging, and I think it has to be something that speaks to people, that speaks to regular people in ways that resonate with them. But on the other hand, you know, there's been this argument about, you know, do we use regular language? Do we, you know, how is it that we can reach out to one another in our community through poems? And I don't think that we need to dumb down what we do, and I don't think we need to focus on making it simple. But I think that the themes, I think we need to show that the themes are universal, that they're things that people in all walks of life can relate to. And I also think, you know, I think in spoken word, I think in a lot of the performances that are out there that are going on, I mean, even rap music, whether you're a fan or not, you know, I think it finds its way in there. I mean, it depends on how narrowly you define, you know, the poem. And I think that one of the things that we could do is broaden the way that we define it, you know, set it to music, do it, you know, do performance pieces, use instruments, whatever you need to do to make it engaging, to make it dynamic, to make it, you know, alive, you know, and vibrant. I think it has to be that way, because I think that that's what we're conditioned to be as people in our modern culture. You know, I think that's the way of it. You know, it's flashing lights, it's short attention spans, it's everybody going and moving. And I think poetry has to move too.
Absolutely. It involves so much emotion, but also it requires, you know, a soul attentiveness, if you will. You know, you have to really, you know, engage yourself. I mean, a poem is only as good as its listener, right? I mean, it has to be an engaging experience. And I'm guilty because I write for TV and film, so I'm one of the guilty guys. I sold out. But having said that,
I've got to cut in for a second here, there, Jeffrey.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, we're down to about 14 minutes, so. Why don't you once again explain the titles of your books and where you can get them, whoever wants to go first. I know we discussed it at the top of the show, but
I'm pretty simple. Wait until 2013, assuming the Mayan calendar doesn't signal the end of the world, which I don't think it does. Even though I joke that I do, I really don't. But yeah, I'm thinking early 2013. If you can get my new book, Sometimes You Invent New Words for Old Losses, from Tainted Coffee Press.
Okay, and Lynn.
You know what? Just hit me up on Facebook or email me, and I'll give it to you. I'll mail it to you. I'll hand it to you. You know, I'll put it in the mail, and there it is. That's all you have to do. You know. You know, it's as simple as that.
Will you play the bongos when you mail it to us?
I will play the bongos if that's, you know, if that's, yeah. You know what?
She's in five bands at least.
Five bands now. No, you know, like I said in the beginning about chapbooks, one of the things, you know, people, you know, there are books with, you know, numbers on the back and publishers and you know, chapbooks are meant to be shared, traded, you know, ways of just saying, you know what, you know, hey, do you have anything I can read? You know what, here you go. It's something that you take out and you hand to somebody. So, you know, because of the amazing internet, we can do that with people all over the world. So it's as simple as you want it, you can have it. You want two, you can have two. I don't care. You know, until they're gone, I'll send them out. I'll send them anywhere. And that's all you have to do. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. So why don't you guys give us a poem each again, and then we can take it out with discussion.
Okay. Are we going to go first,
Lynn.
Who goes first? Okay. Well, you know what the thing is, you know, I think I'll get a little bit away from, like, junkies and some of that stuff because, you know, I do get into a lot of things. Like I said before, there are a lot of themes that sort of come up over and over. But and one of them is if anybody, I don't know if anyone out there like me gets sort of into, you know, astronomy, physics, wormholes, all of that stuff, the multiverse, you know, that time travel, nerd stuff, really nerd stuff. But But this is squares such as these and another all owing to the Shiva fold because they sort of go together. In squares such as these, I'm destitute, an edge, an end, a ruin, or rather, a thinning of things. You get me when I lessen, when I'm prepped to end, when, yes, I'm bitter in your beckon. The body is the science, still useful to the mind. There is difference and resembling, a ruin, or rather, the graying way of exigence. The end has bent to prologue. There is difference and resembling. I find you in the multiverse, behind event horizon. You are in the smallest speck that isn't zero, the bang in a box, the black to vanishing. You are invisible, in the dark matter drown of elements stripped all, owing to the Shiva fold. The Shiva fold, still you live, furious. And it's Paul's turn. Go ahead.
Oh, it's not.
Pass, it's like pass the, you know, what do they do? Some readings, they like pass the stick and then the next person reads. Yeah.
That goes back to the Neanderthal days or the Cro-Magnon days or wherever we came from. All right. Okay, this is another new poem, and this is called The Lava Tube Blues. Our gods were here before your gods were here. We knew you would get here before you knew you would get here. Eden is a place where you are never as alone as you think you are, meaning that it is a lie. And so you make up stories to explain the little creatures you see sprinting into the rocks, whom you chase with all the bloodlust your fear can pump into your meaty calves, which only ever ends with you peering down the asshole of the earth, seeming always so dark, so inviting to your wicked ways, if only it weren't for the cyclical emissions. Our gods were here before your gods. We know more about you than you don't even know who you are. You don't even know who you were, meaning you are a lie, meaning so are we, because for every lie, there is an equal and opposite lie ad infinitum.
Oh, man. Some pretty heavy stuff, Paul Corman Roberts. It's like, I don't know what else I can say. I have to think about stuff like that.
Yeah. that was a little science poem. You know, Lynn went to the science realm. I brought in a little geology. That's actually a geological poem. I read that. That was inspired by an interview I read with the mayor of Reykjavik. Not everybody realizes this, but Iceland has gone under a fundamental radical shift in its government structure. They've kicked a lot of big corporations out of Iceland. A lot of big financing companies and corporations have left Iceland because the people just have stopped cooperating there. And so the mayor of Reykjavik was there. He was, so, you know, he's become a subject of interviews, and he was talking, you know, and it was, you know, he went on this little thing about the stories about, you know, the Icelanders have little stories about creatures, they're dwarves who live in the lava tubes on the volcano. So I kind of dug that. I thought that was a nice little allegory of colonization before you even get to the Americas, and that's what really inspired that. I felt, you know, that the poem I just read could also be true of Hawaii when you break it right down, but I think I like the universal appeal of that, and it also speaks to what you know, when Lynn had been talking earlier about, you know, having universal meaning. I think she's right. She's got the whole picture down with talking about using multimedia and music and other mediums of art to integrate with poetry. But I think there has to be an element of storytelling too, without maybe necessarily overtly telling stories. But people really resonate to, are really drawn, like moths, I guess, to use the moth apocalypse theme to, I think, stories that resonate. And even if a story is not an outright story, or if it's absurdist or surreal, if there's still a way or still an element of getting a story across, people are going to respond to that. And I think that's how you, I think that's how you do it. And I see it happening in live venues. I mean, the more people become so wired into their computer stuff, the more ways they're seeking to sort of have human connection. And sometimes the storytelling circle has a lot of appeal and a lot of draw that a lot of people want to go check out. So I think live performance is a big part of the key. I think you keep pushing it forward in that direction.
And so what does that do for the writer that just likes to hit the page, doesn't like to perform? I mean,
well, you know, they don't have to perform. They can find they can collaborate with other writers who dig their work, who would be willing to perform their work. The series that we do called Anger Management and Revenge, which Lynn is going to be featuring at, I believe, on October 14th here in Oakland, California, the day after our lit crawl, is that kind of a thing. It's a submission-based. We have a few like pre-approved features who come in because we know they're going to give a good set. But but mostly it's submission-based, and people from all over the country send in their work. They themselves can't make it out to the reading, but we get what we call a proxy reader, you know, somebody who is good at reading poetry, somebody who is not, you know, so there are lots of poets who don't enjoy it, who don't enjoy getting up in front of a mic. And with a lot of them, it can be really painful. You know, you can have, I mean, have you ever heard the stories about Lawrence Ferlinghetti reading? I mean, it was, there's the story of Bukowski sitting in the front row watching Ferlinghetti read, and he just, like, at one point, it's like Bukowski gets a crappy lead over. I was like, come on, Larry. Get it out. I've seen Ferlinghetti read. I know it's tough to hear him. He has a very high-pitched voice, and he goes that tone, and it's not the most enjoyable experience. I mean, he's a great writer, but it's not the most enjoyable thing to listen to him read. So that's okay if poets are like that. But there are other, you know, interpreters of poetry or readers of poetry who can do justice to somebody else's writing. That's one way. That's a long answer for a short question. I'm sorry, but that's one way
that's
I see
okay.
Probably it's democratizing the collaborative process, if you will.
Well,
you know what?
Yeah.
I don't mean to disagree with Paul, although it wouldn't be a show if I didn't. There is wonderful work that I am absolutely content to read on the page. I mean, you know, when I say that I sort of write hearing it in my head and think that it needs to be dynamic and performed. There are a lot of writers that I mean dead writers, for example, that can't perform. I mean, there are wonderful writers that I'm perfectly fine reading them on the page, and I love the experience of reading it on the page. So I think that there's a place for both kinds. You know, I don't know that everyone has to be a performer or has to be on the stage. I mean, it is a written, you know, it is something we can appreciate as a written form, and I do love it that way, you know.
I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. I do think there's always a place for the page and a place to immerse oneself in the page. I'm still a reading geek. I'm still a big fan of reading, and I certainly didn't mean to sound like I was monopolizing it all. It's just that all of this can be. It's nice for these things to be like the internet. It's nice for these things to be accessible if they can be, to you know, encourage as people's interest in the literary pursuits as possible.
No, I agree. I agree that it's. I think it's as a. I don't think it's equally important. Personally, I think it's the writing part is the most important. But you know, if you want to get your stuff out there,
right.
just like a band, you're gonna have to go to a place and play music. Like you know, but we are down to like the last minute and a half, and the lady is coming on in a second. So I'd like to thank you for both coming on.
Thank you, Frank.
Oh,
it was a great
you.
Show. I really, really enjoyed it. It was you're a great host, sir.
Thank you.
No, you do a wonderful job. You do.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm sure I'll see you guys in the internet realm, if not in the real world, sooner or later.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on.
Good night.
All right, that was... Paul Coleman Robertson and Lynn Alexander. We originally were going to have them discuss the Literary Underground when they were part of it, but I wanted to keep them on, and they have books to discuss, so we brought them on to read. And if you are wanting to get their stuff and you're out there listening and you don't know how, you can contact me or contact the show if you don't know them. I can send the message along to them, and they can get in touch with you about their stuff and their projects and what they're doing and where they'll be reading. Next week, I'm going to be the guest because I have a book coming out, and Jeffrey, who was on the show, he's going to interview. And that will begin the season 2 And then after that's Rob Plath, and that will begin season two next week. And I'm pretty sure that all the shows in season two are going to be like an hour like tonight, because it's just, we get callers and there's just not enough time to get all the stuff out. I don't know, maybe it will start the hour October 1st with Rob Plath, but I don't know. What the fuck ever.